Pasha. Look. Mom. At me. Nirjitam. Already defeated. Shatru. Oh, enemy. Vrikna. Cut off. Ayuda. My weapon. Bhujam. And my arm. Mride. In this fight. Gatamanam. Still trying. Yathashakti. According to my ability. Tava. Of you. Prana. The life. Jahirshya. With a desire to take away. Translation. Oh, my enemy, just look at me. I have already been defeated. For my weapon and my arm have been cut to pieces. You have already overwhelmed me. But nonetheless, with a desire to kill you, I am trying my best to fight. I am not at all morose, even under such adverse conditions. Therefore, you should give up your moroseness and continue fighting. So purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Dhritarasura was so great and powerful that in effect he was acting as the spiritual master of Indra. Although Dhritarasura was on the verge of defeat, he was not at all affected. He knew that he was going to be defeated by Indra, and he voluntarily accepted that. But since he was supposed to be Indra's enemy, he tried his best to kill Indra. Thus he performed his duty. One should perform his duty under all circumstances, even though one may know what the result will be. Okay? So, Pashyamam Nijitam Chatru Vrikna Yuda Bhujam Hride Gatamanam Yatha Shakti Tava Prana Jihir Shiha. So, Om Ganati Miranda Shah. Gunanjana Shilakaya Chakshudun Meditam Yena Tasmai Shi Gurave Namaha. So here we have Vrikasura with one arm cut off and still rushing towards his enemy, Indra, in spite of knowing that it's predicted that he's going to be killed. Which is really interesting. And it reminds me, before we talk philosophically, of the pastime of Grandfather Bhishma. That actually Bhishma could not be defeated. There was no way anyone could defeat him. So he was asked, how can you be defeated? Now please give me the secret of how we can defeat you. And he said, well, the only way I will put down my weapons is if I am confronted with a woman before me, or someone who used to be a woman. One of two things. Someone who's a woman, someone who used to be a woman. So, of course, he was indirectly referring to Shikhandi. And the story of Shikhandi is quite interesting. That Shikhandi, of course, in his previous life was this lady Amba. And she was one of the three princesses of Kashi that were kidnapped by Grandfather Bhishma to marry Vitra Travirya. So anyway, Grandfather Bhishma kidnapped them all. Two of them got married to Vitra Travirya, but Amba had declared that she was in love with Shalva. And Grandfather Bhishma said, all right, I guess you can go back to see Shalva. And then, to make a long story short, Shalva refused to have anything to do with her because being a Kshatriya, he had this pride. We don't take charity from anyone. So very heartless, of course. He rejected Amba. Amba went back to grandfather Bhishma and said, then you have to marry me. You're the one who kidnapped me. And grandfather Bhishma said, no way. I've taken a vow, akanda brahmachari, to always be brahmachari, number one. Number two, I would never get married to someone who hates me. Because she really hated Bhishma. You know, can you imagine someone saying that, I hate you, therefore marry me? Good idea, right? So, anyway, so she got very angry, eventually enlisted the help of Parashuram, who was Bhishma's spiritual master, to try to convince Bhishma to marry her. Bhishma was able to defeat Parashuram. And then eventually she started performing austerities, got the benediction from Lord Shiva, that she would be the cause of Bhishma's death. And so, therefore, she left her body in such an ecstatic way that she would be the cause of Bhishma's death. And next life, she took birth as the daughter of Drupada, which is a very interesting story. But Lord Shiva had told Drupada that she was his son. So Drupada had so much faith in Lord Shiva that he declared, I have a son, when in fact, for all intents and purposes, physiologically, she was a girl. So even he went to the extent of arranging a marriage of her with another girl. Now this is not Kali Yuga, like now it's actually very common, isn't it? Actually in United States it's legal, Australia it's legal, so many civilized countries. It's legal for men to marry men and women to marry women. And you even have pictures in the newspaper of these things. You ever seen pictures like this? Like two women kissing each other on the marriage altar. So, I'm not going to comment on that. But the point is that when Drupada arranged this particular marriage to another princess, the two princesses got together and they discovered, and the princess who was supposed to be married a man, and she married a woman, discovered that it was a woman. So she went back to her father, complained, and the father said, "That therefore I'm going to kill Drupada for this offense." So, Shikhandi, at that time Shikhandini, basically. Shikhandini didn't like the idea that she was the cause of her father's problems. So she left the kingdom to engage in austerities and practically kill herself. And then, while she was doing that, there was a yaksha, not a rakshasa, a yaksha who was a follower of Kuvera. And he took pity on her and he said, look, I'll give you my masculinity in exchange for your femininity. So this yaksha became a yakshini. And Shikhandini became Shikhandi. You understand? So then he went back, it was a he at this point, went back and said to basically this girl who he married, look, I'm a man, and he proved it. And the king was happy, the other king was happy, Drupada was happy, everyone was happy. So then he was thinking, I have to go back and give my masculinity back to this yaksha. So, you know, that was the deal. So, before that happened, the yaksha had a surprise visit by Kuvera. Kuvera is the yaksha raj. He's in charge of the yakshas. And Kuvera was asking, where is my friend, this yaksha? And this yaksha didn't want to come out to see Kuvera because it's kind of embarrassing. Like if someone comes to see you and you've turned into a woman or a man. Isn't it? It's like if I was saying, where's Rishikesh? Oh, now he's Rishikeshini. It'd be very embarrassing. Isn't it? He wouldn't come to see me. Anyway, so then finally, Kubera discovered what had happened, and he cursed them, and you should remain a lady as long as Shikhandi is alive. And when he dies, then you get back your masculinity. So that was the curse from Kubera. So therefore, Shikhandi was not only Amba in her past life, or his past life, but he was also a girl from the beginning of his life. It's interesting, isn't it? Most people don't know that part of the story. That's in the Mahabharata. Not in the movie, it's in the actual Mahabharata. So what happened is that Grandfather Bhishma, getting back to the battle, he said, this is how I can be defeated, if there's a woman or someone who used to previously be a woman in front of me. And so Arjuna took this instruction from Krishna. It was actually Krishna who gave him the instruction. He said, look, use Shikhandi as a human shield. In other words, just keep him in front of you. And so, therefore, he put Shikhandi in front of him on the chariot, and Arjuna was rushing towards Grandfather Bhishma. And Grandfather Bhishma, in order not to fire any arrows close to Arjuna, which would have been Shikhandi, he was firing his arrows to the side. And basically what happened is that Arjuna started to fill Grandfather Bhishma's body with arrows. But the interesting thing in relationship to this verse is that Grandfather Bhishma even kept rushing at Arjuna in spite of being filled with arrows. It's described there were so many arrows in Grandfather Bhishma's body that you couldn't even keep your finger or put your finger between the arrows. Can you imagine that? I mean, obviously they didn't hit his face. Arjuna was careful about that. But every other part of the body, from the toes to the neck, was filled with just arrows everywhere. And of course, Grandfather Bhishma didn't die because he had gotten that benediction from his father, Shantanu. Then when he arranged for Shantanu to marry Satyavati, Shantanu said, you will not die unless you want to. So there, but he kept rushing. He didn't give up. Well, even when it was apparent that he had lost the battle. Because he had this sense of duty. And eventually Arjuna had to fire so many arrows that Grandfather Bhishma was knocked on his back and he couldn't move. At that point, he basically gave up. When it was impossible to move. So that shows great determination. Of course, Grandfather Bhishma is really known for his keeping promises. This is actually the essential part of duty, keeping promises, isn't it? He's known for that because in spite of all sorts of problems, he always kept his promise. Now, on the other hand, one can say that that was even a fault, which is really interesting too. That's an interesting analysis of promises. Promises should be kept, but when they're going to have some adverse effect and cause harm, then at that point you can break a promise. Like Grandfather Bhishma kept his promise up to a fault. Because why? He had promised to support whoever was the king of Hastinapur. And unfortunately, you had Duryodhana and, of course, Dhritarashtra, who were in charge of Hastinapur. And he, because of his promise, he supported them. And therefore he supported Adharma. So the point is that one only has to keep promises when they're dharmic. Like if you, I mean, let's say a wife promises to obey her husband and the husband says, kill that cow. Isn't it? Like at the time of marriage, yeah, there's a promise. Don't they still do that? You serve your husband, and the husband's supposed to listen to his wife, right? No, they don't say that. They should be equal. They both should listen to each other. Anyway, so let's take that hypothetical situation, and the husband says, kill this cow, dear. And the wife has the right to say no. And under certain circumstances, you can even lie to protect someone's life. Let's say there's some dacoits And they want to kill Hrishikesh because he has a lot of gold. So neat. So let's say they want to come and kill Hrishikesh. And I'm hiding him in the back of my room. And these big dacoits come here. And they say, "Where is that Hrishikesh? We want him." And I say, "I haven't seen him for 2 weeks." Is that a lie? Yes, it's a lie. But in that case, there's higher principles and lower principles. However, under ordinary circumstances, we should never break our vows or promises. Modern society, unfortunately, is based on personal satisfaction. So the promises in modern society are meant to be broken. If that doesn't please you, if something doesn't please you. You know, people break promises because it's not pleasing to them to keep the promise. In other words, everything's based on the self. Whereas in the traditional culture, Vedic culture, and even other cultures in the world traditionally, I mean, even traditionally European culture and traditionally Chinese culture, any traditional culture, there's a sense of identity with society. You understand? You're working for society, not only yourself, not only your family, but the whole of society. That is your identity as a member of society. But in the modern day, society is supposed to serve us. The individual is the king. And society's only business is to give the individual satisfaction. You see the difference? Whereas traditionally, the individual works for the benefit of society. And we see so many examples of that. I mean, not only Grandfather Bhishma, but look at Lord Ram. He was the king, or emperor, Samraj. Anyway, he was the emperor, and for the good of society, he had to ask his wife to go away. And there was no question of how dear Sita Devi was to Ram, and how dear Ram was to Sita Devi. I mean, people often ask that question, you know, why would he do such a thing? To send his wife away just because the citizens were disturbed, or some citizens, not even all of them. Because he considered his first and foremost duty to society. And if someone doesn't act properly with that duty to society, they set a bad example. As Krishna says in the Gita, yad yad acharati shrestas tat tat evetaro janaha. As the shrestas, the leaders of society, act, then other people follow. So the leaders have to be what Prabhupada called exemplary. For those of you who don't know what that word means, it means good examples. They have to be good examples. And even if they have an inclination to do something else, they can't do it. It's not their duty. It's not their dharma. I mean, the other day I was speaking to the devotees. I don't think I spoke about it in Fiji. One time I went to visit some disciples in a city in the United States called Minneapolis, which is near, not Minneapolis, actually Milwaukee, sorry, which is near Chicago. So we arrive, you know, they pick me up in the airplane, and they say, "Maharaj, we want to do something fun with you." Or for you, not with you. For you. We want to take you parachuting. You know parachuting? Not only parachuting, you jump with that. You jump, first of all, free fall from the airplane. And then after that, you open your parachute. They even have that in Fiji, too, right? So we want to take this, we're going to take you to this airport, we're going to go jumping with you. And I was thinking, I wasn't thinking, is it going to be pleasurable, not pleasurable, because obviously it's probably pretty ecstatic to jump out of an airplane. you know, it'd probably be pretty interesting, fly in the air. It's pretty safe, I mean sometimes it doesn't open, the parachute. And then forget it, you're finished. But then I was just thinking, then you go back to Godhead, no problem. Hare Krishna. So, but then I thought, you know, what sort of example is this for devotees? I have a position, I have a responsibility to society, to my disciples in the ISKCON society as a sannyasi. Why should a sannyasi be jumping from airplanes? I mean, what is the justification for such a thing? Maybe if he had a banner saying Hare Krishna behind him as he was jumping from the airplane, maybe you could justify it. But no, seriously, there's no justification for it. So I'm identifying myself. I'm just giving this personal example. I'm identifying myself as a servant of society. Of course, a servant of Prabhupada. You know, also I ask, whenever I make a decision, serious decision in life, I always ask, internally, I ask Prabhupada, you know, what would you say about this? Would you say I should do it or not do it? I mean, I often approach people who have left ISKCON and ask them that same question. I said, you've left ISKCON and made your own society where you're the big guru. Okay, fine. But if you went before Prabhupada, what would he say? Would Prabhupada say, very nice, you left ISKCON. You've done a very good job. No, you can't, none of us, even though those of you who are not that familiar with Prabhupada, could hear Prabhupada saying that. Prabhupada would say, you know, all right, come back to our society and bring whatever you've done, your assets and everything, and cooperate with the GBC, cooperate with the structure of the movement, and this will please me very much. Prabhupada said, cooperation is bhakti. Actually, it's a very interesting statement Prabhupada made. Cooperation is bhakti. Think about it. And so therefore, that's how I see Prabhupada speaking in such a circumstance. So therefore we should be attached to our duty, not simply for the sake of duty. That's niyamagraha. I mean, it's one thing to say, do your duty, it's your duty. I mean, sometimes parents try to do that with their kids without explaining why a duty is a duty. You know, the parents say, your duty is to serve me. Okay. Or if the husband, let's take a more typical example. The husband says to the wife, your duty is to serve me. Okay. But give me a reason. What's the reason? There has to be some motivation for it, because people are not just machines. Like, you could say to your computer, your duty is to do email. And who cares whether the computer is happy or not? Because the computer doesn't experience happiness or distress. It's just a stupid machine. But we are people, so there has to be some motivation. And the motivation should be connected with bhakti. Why should I do my duty? Because it pleases my guru. It pleases the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And Krishna actually says that in the Gita, that if one follows his specific duty, even if he can do someone else's duty better, then that pleases him. To follow your specific dharma or duty, according to your psychophysical nature, according to that ascertained by your guru. I mean, the question was raised yesterday. Someone asked me a question. How do we inspire people to have good sadhana when they're living in their homes separate from the temple, obviously? I mean, in the old days, when I joined the movement, nobody lived in their home. Everybody lived in the temple. I mean, we had grahastas, children, men, women, you know, everything, just all crammed into one room. Basically, I remember one time I was in Dallas, Texas, in the beginning. We had one room where 30 men would sleep in at night. And the ladies had a separate room, of course. And you never knew who was going to be next to you when you woke up the next morning. Pretty interesting, isn't it? You also couldn't roll over and sleep, or else you'd commit a Vaishnava aparada. And you couldn't snore. not allowed. So anyway, so obviously under those conditions, we all had this basic training in Krishna consciousness, because when it was time for Mangal Arati, you had to get up. There's no question of sleeping because everybody's chanting loudly. And basically where you were sleeping was the temple room anyway. So it's not such a good idea to be lying in the corner of the temple room during Mangal Arati. Can you imagine that? You know, everybody's jumping and dancing over you. So, because nowadays in some temples they have closed circuit TV so someone can see Mangal Arati in bed. I was talking to one of my friends in Los Angeles, called him up on the phone, it was a time difference, and I said, how are you doing? He said, wait a second, I have to offer obeisances to the deities. And they had, on his TV, they had Mangal Arati, so he was offering obeisances to the deities. So, anyway, getting back to the point, is that in the early days, yes, we had this definite basic training where you had to get up in the morning, you had to go through the morning, and it was a good thing to be trained like that. Of course, Prahlad Maharaj speaks about that, Brahmachari Gurukule Vasundanta Gurorhitam, that the Brahmachari lives in the ashram of the spiritual master and he learns to work for the benefit of the spiritual master, and all good qualities develop as a result of that. So we don't have the same situation now. We don't have many brahmacharis, right? And just about everybody is living outside. So the point is how to have people have good sadhana, you know, wake up early and things like that. That requires instilling in people a sense of duty towards the spiritual master. You have obligations towards someone. It's a personal thing. That's bhakti. Why do we cooperate? Because I have an obligation towards Prabhupada. Why am I doing my duty? Because I have an obligation towards Prabhupada. It's all personal. It's not simply, this is my duty because it's my duty. So there has to, how do we do that? We develop personal relationships with each other first. Like we're talking about, dadati pratigranati guyam akyati prichati. That loving exchanges. When we have loving exchanges with the devotees, we definitely develop a sense of obligation towards the other devotees, right? That we're obliged to do something. Just like I can see with my disciples, I have the sense that I have a duty towards my disciples, not only towards Prabhupada, not only towards the deities, not only towards the Krishna consciousness movement, but I have a duty towards those who've taken shelter. And this sense of personalism, because we're personalists, that's the point I'm getting to, keeps us fixed in our sense of duty. Does everyone understand the point? Because duty without personalism is dry. You will not stick to it. Just like here, Vritrasura has a duty towards Krishna. I mean, and it was his duty to act as a demon. Of course, most of you don't have that duty. To act as demons. Anyone here have that duty? No. You do it spontaneously. So, spontaneous demons. So, no one here is a demon, but sometimes we do exhibit demoniac qualities. Lust, anger, greed, all these things are demoniac qualities. You can read in the Bhagavad Gita about the qualities of the demon, you know, pride, arrogance, conceit, harshness. These are all demoniac qualities. And godly qualities are avaya sattva samshuddhi, jnana yoga vivasati, taking shelter of Krishna, being free of fear, being equal poise, samadama kapaksha cham. All these are godly qualities. So, therefore, if we want to exhibit godly qualities, I mean, then we have to have a motivation. We have to have a sankalpa. And so, when I get up in the morning, I think, I'm doing this for Prabhupada, I'm doing this for other living entities. And I was actually reading something very interesting yesterday, it was a poem that Prabhupada, it's called Vrindavan Bhajan that Prabhupada had written. Anybody read this poem by Prabhupada? In this bhajan, he was criticizing the Babaji's in Radhakund. And one of the criticisms, of course, there were several different criticisms, I mean, pretty heavy criticisms. Devotees should read this poem. Prabhupada wrote such nice poetry. The criticism was that basically they have a duty to the rest of the world if they have Krishna consciousness, because people are going to hell all over the world. It's Kali Yuga. And so simply to sit for one's own personal benefit and engage in what Prabhupada called Nirjana Bhajan. Nirjana means without people. You know, understand? The word Nirjana. Did you know that? Nirjana. Jana means people. So, to engage in bhajan without people, Prabhupada forbade it. Prabhupada condemned it. Because that is not our duty. And it's impersonal. Unless you're getting ready to die, then you can do Nirjana Bhajan. That's okay. We don't object if you can't preach. But Prabhupada actually said he wanted to die like a kshatriya in the battlefield, preaching Krishna consciousness. So Prabhupada was criticizing like that because they're neglecting this personal point that people are suffering and you're just sitting there enjoying yourself in Krishna consciousness. That's the real point. You're trying to enjoy. And Prabhupada said that's an illusion. You're trying to enjoy Krishna consciousness when so many people are suffering. So anyway, so duty has to be inspired by personalism. That's the message I wanted to make, to give today. It has to be inspired by personalism. Then one can be very much fixed. Like Dhritavritaha. Vyavasayatmika buddhir ekeha kurunandana. Bahushaktasurantascha. So anyway, so this is some of the points. So Dhritarasura was very fixed in his duty in spite of having one arm missing. He knew he was supposed to keep attacking Indra. Even later on, when he has two arms missing, he keeps attacking Indra. If you read the story later on, he finally swallows Indra. You know, how are you going to fight without two arms? I mean, even if someone scratched me, I'd run away from the fight. Right? You know, but he had two arms missing. Kumbhakarna was the same, actually. There's been so many interesting stories. Even Kumbhakarna was fighting with two arms missing. And finally, he had to have his head cut off, his trunk cut off. So he had two arms missing, and he was still continuing to fight, and eventually he swallowed. So this is the determination we have to have in serving Krishna, but it's based on relationship with the spiritual master and the other devotees. Then even someone who's living outside, who had never had the basic training, will actually be able to do it. Will actually be able to wake up early. If someone is not able to wake up early, that means they don't have a personal commitment to the guru, to Krishna, and to the other devotees. So that's the secret. That was the question that was raised yesterday. It was a very good question. I was thinking about the answer to it. So any questions or comments? We have about 2 minutes left to class. Yeah. 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 Bart Maharaj. So he's asking a question about Bart Maharaj, who eventually became a deer. That Bart Maharaj actually became attracted to a deer. I mean, there's several reasons. First of all, he gave up the association of devotees. He was all by himself. I think that's the most important reason. That when you're associated with devotees, Prabhupada said it's like many sticks together that can't be broken. And when you're by yourself, it's like one stick that's easy to break. I mean, that's one reason. But even so, he didn't have that determination, that fixity of purpose. Now, I don't know Bart Maharaj's psychology. I don't claim to be his psychologist. But I do know that if one has a personal, deep relationship with someone whom you're obligated to, you will function in that capacity. I mean, that's why the marriage is very important, because there's a deep personal relationship. You're obligated towards the person. You understand? Or the relationship between spiritual master and disciple. You're obligated towards the person. Rather than thinking, me, 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 because it's a me culture. I mean, if you watch any of these films, the Bollywood films especially, or Hollywood, or whatever it is, then you start to develop this me culture rather than us culture, or, you know, Krishna culture. Krishna culture is the exact opposite of me culture. Ishwaroham aham bhogi siddham balavan sukhi. That's the me culture. If something's not pleasing to me, then I'll give it up. Even if it devastates society, even if it's harmful to other people, it hurts other people, that's all right. Because I can't live my whole life like this. You ever hear that argument? Don't ask me to do this because I can't live my whole life like this because it'll make me miserable. But actually, you won't be miserable if you're thinking of that higher purpose. You can execute so many austerities and things that ordinarily would not be pleasing to you, but they are pleasing because you have a higher personal relationship with Krishna. You know, we can do so many things. Just like sometimes I give the example that I changed my diet so I could serve Prabhupada. I mean, it's not easy to change your diet, to give up the things you're attached to, like sugar, ghee. I didn't like oil, but ghee. Prabhupada said, ghee, Vedic sense gratification is ghee. Beg, borrow, steal, get yourself some ghee. If you really want a nice taste, cook in ghee. You understand? So anyway, I gave it up from one day to another. Nobody trained me up. Nobody was watching me. Nobody was yelling at me. Because I understood my duty is to serve Prabhupada. My duty is not to serve my own senses. So you have to have that change of paradigm right there. If you really want to advance in Krishna consciousness, or if you want to be a good citizen even. I mean, even materially, they talk about, you know, sacrificing your life for your country, right? You ever heard of that? Sacrifice your life, you become a great hero. I'm not saying you should do that. So, but that's just extended bodily consciousness, of course. We understand that. But you, or sacrificing your life for humanity, joining Greenpeace or something. You know Greenpeace is? They just got arrested in Russia. But anyway, so sacrificing your life for humanity, but that's extended bodily consciousness. So keep extending it further and further, and then you sacrifice your life for Krishna. And Krishna's represented. You have a call. They want oil. So anyway, so that's the point. You just keep extending, and then you'll also be a model citizen. Like Prabhupada said, when he was asked the quality of his disciples, he said they're perfect gentlemen and perfect ladies. So you keep extending and extending until you come to Yastu Sarvani Bhutani Atman Ayivanu Pashyati. That everyone's part and parcel of Krishna, we're all brothers and sisters, so I'm gonna work for everybody. A devotee actually Sarva Bhute Hite Rata. A devotee works for the welfare Hite of all living entities. Sarva Bhute, Sarva Bhutanam. Of all living entities. So that's the point. What is my identity? I'm supposed to be working for the benefit of all living entities, serving my spiritual master, instead of thinking I'm supposed to enjoy Krishna consciousness. But you will enjoy Krishna consciousness if you have that change of vision, change of paradigm. It's very enjoyable. I mean, doing things out of love, sacrificing things you would have liked to do out of love, is actually the highest pleasure you can get. It's the highest pleasure. So any other questions or comments? Yeah. Yeah.
If he was what? Why did he keep fighting? Because that was his order from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Even though he, and the results are up to Krishna anyway. He was following Krishna's order. It was a pastime. This is a pastime, obviously. That he was following Krishna's order. He wanted to go back to Godhead as soon as possible. And it was his duty to fight Indra. Why was his duty to fight Indra? To teach Indra a lesson. What did Indra do wrong before? He had killed Brahmins before. He killed his spiritual master. He offended his spirit. One, he offended Brihaspati. He killed Twasta. He killed Visvarup, who was Twasta's son, who was acting as his guru. I mean, Indra needs a good lesson. And so what's the best lesson to give him? But to attack him, and then the person who's attacking him is a better devotee than you, and he's preaching to you. So it was his duty to preach to Indra, to show Indra what real dedication is. Because Indra, we hear so many stories, in many cases thinks of his own senses. He has a big responsibility, but what does he do when he sees Gautama Rishi's wife, Ahalya? What does he do? You know the story? Indra, he saw Ahalya, and he thought, I'll just make a trick and make believe I'm Gautama Rishi and have a licit relationship with her. And then what happened? It's good to turn it off before class. Or put it on vibrate. So what did he do? He had an illicit relationship. So he's thinking of himself. He's not thinking of his position. So the lesson for Indra is, here's this demon who's being killed and he doesn't give up his duty. But Indra, who's enjoying life with the Apsaras, is even looking for another lady on the earth planet. He should mind his own business. He already has the Apsaras, right? But he's so damn lusty that he can't keep his eyes off of Ahalya. That means very little sense of duty. Because the attraction will arise. But what is your sense of duty? What is my duty? What is my obligation? And he sees Krishna. I mean, you can say, well, Indra, you know, he's just a demigod. But as a demigod, he has Krishna as his brother. Did you know that? Who's Indra's brother? Who's Krishna? Anyone know? Vamandev. I mean, and he worships Krishna. You read the Brihad Bhagavatamrita. He's worshiping Krishna. He sees Lord Vishnu. I mean, come on. I mean, he has a lot more facility than you and I do. I mean, of course, we see Radhakrishna Vihari, which is kind of nice. But, you know, I haven't had a conversation with Krishna for a while. And Krishna's not my brother. My brother is a meat-eating doctor. It's not Krishna. So, I mean, look at Indra, all the facility he has. And what is the sense of duty? I'm not saying he doesn't have any sense of duty, but it wasn't strong enough. So that's really what protects us, our sense of duty, obligation, personal relationship. I think we have to end now. So it's time to greet the deities. All glories to Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.